Hej och välkomna hit allihopa. Jag heter Rebecca Jonsson och pluggar här på universitetet på Policys kandidatprogram. Jag är också aktiv i en kristen studentförening som heter Agape som är med och anordnar den här kvällen. Vi är jättetacksamma att Dr. Ravi Zacharias och hans team har kommit hit idag. Och vi är även jättetacksamma för alla er som har kommit hit idag. Vi har folk från olika delar av världen här idag. Vi har folk från Italien, Tyskland, Holland, Finland och även från många delar av Sverige. Så därför så kommer vi att ta resten av kvällen på engelska.
Thank you for coming this evening. My name is Barrett Harkins. I am full-time staff with the student organization that she mentioned, Agape Sverige. My wife and I are the national campus directors for that. And about 2.5 years ago, we sent an email to RZIM Ministries and asked them to come and join us for this evening, and they said 2.5 years. And so that was the longest I had ever looked into my calendar to think about putting anything in other than maybe, well, not even my wedding. And we waited with much anticipation, and I hope that you have looked forward to this evening as well. For a lot of you, you've come from pretty far places. We're very excited to have you, very excited to have Dr. Zacharias as well. I'd like to mention that tonight is being live-streamed all over the world, that when a live-stream event happens with RZI Ministry, an email goes out to over 50,000 people. So our crowd tonight is possibly much larger than this room. I would also like to mention that as a student organization, we've been working together with another student organization who's been very important in pulling this evening off, called Credo. Credo and Agape both believe that life has questions. Many of those questions are difficult. But as Christian organizations, we believe that those questions are best answered in the person of Jesus Christ. And by and large, that is why we have invited Dr. Zacharias to here tonight. So no matter where you're at in your life, no matter what you're thinking about and questions, we believe that there are answers to those questions, and we hope that tonight provides a little bit of insight into finding perhaps some of those other questions that you may be struggling with. I'd like to mention tonight also that there will be a question and answer period following Dr. Zacharias' talk. You are most welcome to go ahead and SMS questions to a phone. If you have a pen and paper ready, go ahead and write this number down. The number is, if you're dealing with an out-of-country phone, +46, it's the country code, 0738966752. 0738966752. You're most welcome at any point to SMS a question you might have, and we'll probably start off the question and answer period with a question from those SMSs. During the question and answer period, there are two microphones that are set up directly right here in front or in the middle section. Please go to queue up behind those microphones. You're welcome to ask one question, but please keep it brief so that we can have as many questions as possible. Dr. Zacharias will be joined by two members of his speaking team, Michael Ramsden and Dr. Nabil Qureshi. Nabil Qureshi tomorrow will actually be speaking as well on his life and his book that he has written called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, and His Journey to Faith in Jesus Christ. That is tomorrow at 4 o'clock in this same room. We invite you to come and join us for that. As well as tomorrow, Dr. Zacharias and his team will be speaking again, starting off. Michael Ramsden will start us off in the evening, and then Dr. Zacharias will finish us off in the evening with Why I Am a Christian. So tonight and tomorrow really work together. Tonight, Dr. Zacharias will be talking about secularization, its control and power, and tomorrow will be Why I Am a Christian. Dr. Zacharias is an incredible person. I could list off his very long accolades, foremost of which for us here in Sweden, the UN. He has spoken at twice at their annual prayer breakfast, which starts off the UN annual meetings. And there are many other things that we could mention about him, but what I love most about Dr. Zacharias, and I think this comes off in his speaking, but as I have gotten to know him over the past 24 hours just a little bit, what I appreciate most about him is that whether he's speaking to the UN or billionaires or world leaders around the world, or whether he's speaking to me, I feel valued. And I think that that comes across. And the truth that he speaks and the things he thinks about and talks about, I think, are worth taking our time Because as I used to tell some of my friends when I lived in different parts of the world, when we would discuss different parts of religion or thought, and we'd get frustrated perhaps and not be able to find agreement. At the end of it, I would say, but let's talk about this again tomorrow, because if anything in life is worth thinking about, these are the things. And those things that are deep and most meaningful, when someone is as humble as Dr. Zacharias, it brings me to thinking even more deeply. And so I hope tonight that you are able to do that as well. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Ravi Zacharias.
Thank you very much. Well, Barrett's comment reminded me of when I was living in Canada, and somewhere in the early part of 1972, I got a telephone call. I was in my undergraduate studies, about ready to graduate, and somebody had given me a call and wanted to know if I could speak on May the 6th, coming up in a few months. I said, well, let me check my diary. For some reason, that date rings a bell. And I looked at my diary, and it was to be my wedding day. So it is good to enter your wedding day in the diary as well. My wife has never forgiven me for it, but 42 years later, the wound is slowly closing, that I almost took a speaking engagement. And the irony is, our honeymoon was in Niagara Falls, and the speaking engagement was in Niagara Falls too. So she looked at me and said, don't you dare even think of, for all I know, she's watching right now. Well, I'll be joined after I finish speaking by two of my good-looking colleagues, Michael Ramsden from Oxford and Nabil Qureshi. So when I finish speaking, if you have any questions, Michael's doctoral work is in international monetary law, and he's also lectured in philosophy and ethics. Nabil Qureshi is a medical doctor by training and picked up a couple of other postgraduate degrees in theology and biblical studies, heading off to Oxford this fall to do his PhD. So if you have any questions on philosophy or ethics afterwards, Michael will be able to answer them. Any on science and world religions, Nabil will be able to answer them. If you have any questions on Indian cuisine and recipes, on where you get the best tandoori chicken or whatever, I'll be delighted to field those questions. But with two such illustrious people, I'm reminded of this occasion where it was an English setting, and the Englishmen were huddling around a table, and a Japanese gentleman walked in and sat down at one of these tables. So the Englishman thought he would help him and looked over to him and picked up a knife and said, this be knifey. Then he picked up a fork and said, and this be forky. And the spoon, and this be spoony. And to their utter surprise, the Japanese gentleman was the main speaker for the evening. And he went up to the front and delivered his talk in flawless English, came back and sat down and looked at his friends and the gentleman there and said, did you like his speechy? So I feel a little bit like the likey speechy one here with two of these boys about to come on later on. You'll enjoy them. I want to give you a bit of a lighthearted story here. Unfortunately, it's a sad event that is as a backdrop, but I hope that does not offend anybody here. The point that is being made is something very different, and that's why I am actually quoting this. I was writing a book, one of my books in Thailand, when I got this from a friend of mine in India. And it says, What is globalization? An illustration in Princess Diana's death. An English princess with an Egyptian boyfriend in a German car, driven by a Dutch driver, crashes in a French tunnel while being chased by Italian paparazzi on Japanese bikes, treated by a Portuguese doctor with Brazilian medicine. This mail was written by a South Indian living in North India, writing to a westernized Indian from Atlanta, but writing in Thailand, and is sent from the clouds on a Chinese laptop smuggled by a Pakistani via Nepal and Myanmar, probably through the black market in Malaysia, and then smuggled into India, and then sold to this owner. Amazing. All of that is actually possible. A lot of it happened. We think of globalization today as something that's a given. A day ago, I was in Atlanta, Georgia. Then you take a plane, fly in through Amsterdam, and you're here. From here, I'm heading on to parts of Asia and doing some speaking out there. You walk into any shopping centers and the shops begin to look the same. The brand names are the same. The market prices are just as elevated because of the familiarity of the name. And we talk about the globalized perspective with which we live. And yet, even though our communication has grown exponentially with our capacities to communicate, be it visual, or be it by way of hearing, or be it through prestigious universities such as the one in which I'm now present and given the privilege to speak, the fact of the matter is that our worldviews, even in this auditorium, may be dramatically different. We may be globalized in terms of capacities, but there is an internalization of our worldviews which may be poles apart from the person sitting next to you. Ted Turner, who was the mogul behind CNN and many other television networks, talking in the 1970s, said television was going to solve all of our communication barriers. We were going to eliminate all of these walls, and we would be able to speak eyeball to issues on matters of great significance. The first time I spoke at the United Nations many years ago, I was living in New York at that time, and I was sitting at a table with a gentleman from one country and a few others, and just to make conversation, nervous about where to begin, I looked at the ambassador next to me and I said to him, "What is the greatest strength of the UN? And he said to me that we are talking to each other rather than not talking to each other. I thought, wow, this is really very encouraging right now. So then I looked at him and said, "What is the greatest weakness of the UN? He said that we don't talk the same language. I said, "Don't you have interpreters?" He said, yeah, but that's not what I mean. He says, "You see that man?" And he pointed to another ambassador at another table. He says, "When we talk peace, for him peace means when we've settled the issue with his guns pointing in my direction. When I talk peace, I want to eliminate guns completely." Now, in the UN, if the ideas behind their words provide such adversarial meanings and equivocation constantly, can you imagine how difficult it has become in a world of trying to find answers to the question of truth? You know, the motto here, the words, you know, it is more important to think freely than, to think, it's more important to think that which is right than rather just to think freely. And many students disagreed with that. They said the freedom of thought is more important than the correction of thought. Now, I somehow assumed that behind that comment, two things lay. Number one, that the people who disagreed with that thought their conclusion was right. That they assumed it was a right kind of thinking to think about this dissonance. But the second thing I assume what really lurks behind it is the critique. Who is going to determine what is right? That's what really, I think, lies behind the critique. And now as we interact with cultures and so on, and I talk about secularization, its control and power, I want to talk about what it is that cultures really are wrestling with today, and how do we find answers with all of our systemic differences and our contradictions of values. In the 1980s, Daniel Yankelevich, a sociologist, wrote an article on the search for meaning in America and the shifting values in American life. So that was over 30 years ago that he wrote it. And he quoted another famous sociologist in the beginning of his article. And he said this, Culture is an effort to provide a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all human beings in the passage of their lives. Simple definition. It's an effort to find a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all of us in the passage of their lives. Now, the fascinating thing about that statement is, I'm not even sure everybody in every culture will accept that definition. I remember at the University of Iowa, when I quoted this in a talk, a student went up to the microphone and said to me, "Who told you life needed to be coherent? Where did you get this idea from, that life needed to be coherent? Is this another Western idea we are foisting upon the rest of the world?" And I have learned long enough, you allow anybody to talk long enough, they will trip themselves up, which is the danger we have. So I looked at her and I said, "Ma'am, I will be happy to answer your question if you will first answer mine. Do you want my answer to be coherent, or may my answer be incoherent?" And everybody in the hall, about 1,500 of them packed out there, started laughing. I said, no, I don't want you to laugh at her. Please don't. I want to hear from you. Do you want my answer to be coherent? Or is it okay for my answer to be incoherent? You see, the games we play sometimes, we demand of a counter-perspective coherence while we may live systemically contradictory in our own worldviews. That's the danger with which we now live, especially in a totally secularized consciousness. Now, before I go any further, let me say this to you. Ought our world governments, should they be secular? Yes. In fact, every worldview that I give to you, every sociological idea that I give to you, in principle, is a good way to be. But if they are taken to an extreme distortion, that's when the danger points really come in. Let me explain what I mean. You see, because religion itself has not got a good history in how religious authorities have dealt with cultures and how they've dominated and imposed their worldview, where the person ought to have had the freedom to believe or to disbelieve. So just to say, instead of a secular leadership, we need to have a religious leadership, history is replete with examples of the abuse both have made. But the problem with secularism and secularization is actually very intrinsic in religious worldviews. Often it's a perversion of the terms and the application of it. Let me explain myself. What do I mean by secularization? Secularization is defined in these words. It's the process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. It is a process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. For example, if you were watching a television program, say, in the United States or in parts of Europe and so on, maybe even here, and the issue of a great social controversy is raised, whatever it may be, sacredness of life, sacredness of sexuality, whatever it is, if that subject is being discussed and there's a platform full of authorities and you take a professor, a philosopher, a lawyer, a judge, a psychologist, a medical practitioner, a social theorist, and in the middle of it put a clergyman on that platform in that panel. Who do you think the audience will assume to be the most prejudiced in his or her view on that panel? they will immediately assume the clergyman is the most prejudiced because he has a transcendent worldview. Therefore, he's ideologically prejudiced. The rest of them live with a completely objective worldview, be it in psychology or philosophy or law or whatever it is. That's the way we have seen religious ideas. And so when we talk about secularization, the process by which religious ideas, institutions, and interpretations have lost their social significance. Now, when we move into this theoretically to its practical outworkings, where do we end up? How do we really live in society with a total secularized consciousness? The English journalist Steve Turner describes culture secularized in these words. Here's what he says. Who are we? What is our creed? Then he answers with tongue-in-cheek, a fair bit of humor. We believe in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay, as long as you don't hurt anyone, to the best of your definition of hurt and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that adultery is fun. We believe that taboos are the only thing that are taboo. We believe that everything is getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man, just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think some of his morals were actually bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same, at least the ones that we read were. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ on matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end, and if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average. What's average is normal. What's normal is good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. Americans should beat their guns into tractors, and the Russians would be sure to follow. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions. Conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust and history will alter. We believe that there is no absolute truth, accepting the truth that there is no absolute truth. We believe in the rejection of creeds and the flowering of individual thought. And then he puts this postscript: if chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear a state of emergency, sniper kills 10, youths go looting, bomb blasts school, it is but the sound of man worshiping his maker. If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshiping his maker. Just 2 weeks ago, my colleagues and I were in the little place of Newtown in Connecticut. Where a little over 14 months ago, this 20-year-old walks by, marches in with his firepower and mows down 26 people, 20 of them plus were first graders. And it is extremely difficult to speak in an audience that has lived with a wound as painful and as fresh as that. But you see, Nietzsche himself, when he coined the phrase "God is dead," said, because of what we have accomplished in doing, the 20th century might well become the bloodiest century in history. And universal madness will break out. Might well become the bloodiest century in history. And he was right, as in the 20th century, we ended up killing more in warfare than the previous 19 centuries put together. Here's the problem. What is the problem with a totally secularized consciousness? The problem is one of definitions. Let me ask you, for example, give you this illustration. I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I've lived there now for nearly 30 years. But in the 1980s, in Atlanta, there was a very historic trial taking place of a man who was a kingpin in the pornographic industry. So vile was his pornography that they said his pornography and his presentations made the Playboy magazine look like kids' stuff. The man was called Larry Flint and taken to trial. The irony of it is that in the process of selecting the jury, the man defending Larry Flint was questioning the potential jurors, and this was one of his questions to them. Do you belong to a church? Do you go to church? And the reason he wanted the answer to the question is because he believed anybody who went to church would not be a good jurist for his client and would have prejudiced opinions about pornography. So he was looking for zombies, people who had no view on matters like this. Finally, after 5 days, they found some people who did not belong to a church. In the south of the United States, that was very difficult to find. So they found somebody. Now, the man questioning the witnesses had a brilliant ploy. Witnesses who were testifying against his client, he would go at it this way. Have you ever walked into an art gallery? Yes. Have you ever paid to go into an art gallery? Yes. Have you ever paid to go into an art gallery where there are paintings by the grandmasters of art of unclothed people? Yes. Of people nude in their paintings? Yes. You've done that. You've gone into an art gallery, you've paid to go in, and that's the kind of paintings in that gallery as well. Yes. Would you please tell this jury why you call that art and you call my client's stuff pornography? Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Now, you're not going to sit on there and say, may I first give to you my philosophical definition of art? You can't do that as a witness. But suppose this man were sitting opposite me in a coffee shop and said, Ravi, what's the difference? You tell me. You know, I think there are two illustrations I would like to give to him. When Michelangelo first started doing his great work, he looked at him and wanted him to understand what he was doing. He said, do you know what you're doing? He said, yeah. He said, why do you want to do this? He said, because I want to see man as God sees man. And the teacher said, that's excellent. Just remember, you are not God. Just remember, you are not God. C.S. Lewis, in his book, A Pilgrim's Regress, has a brilliant analogy that I think is a great response. It is this. It's an allegorical journey of Lewis, the great Oxonian, the great Cambridge scholar, and who was himself in a search for his spiritual, on his spiritual journey. He flirted with atheism, flirted with pantheism, and ultimately, as he made his commitment to Jesus Christ in his book, Surprised by Joy. In his book, A Pilgrim's Regress, he allegorically traces his journey. He refers to himself as a person called John. Now, I want you to listen to this very carefully because it's brilliantly done. So John is on this journey, and he calls it A Pilgrim's Regress for a reason, the book. It's because he said, as I was making my search and pursuing answers, I turned away from many options. I didn't quite know why. But after I found my commitment to Jesus Christ, I took a regressive journey because I did have the explanation and the answers. That's why he calls it A Pilgrim's Regress. But now as he's moving along, he describes himself as John, trapped in a mountain that he calls the spirit of the age, living by all the pleasures of the spirit of the age. But ironically, he describes himself as a man handcuffed and in chains. In the spirit of the age, allegorically, he actually sees himself trapped. And while he's in those handcuffs, he's pondering all the major issues. And then the waiter, representing the spirit of the age, brings him his breakfast, unbinds him, and he's going to enjoy the food. And he said, I made the mistake of commenting on the deliciousness of the milk. And the waiter said, you only call it milk? What is milk? It's the secretion of a cow, isn't it? It secretes urine. It secretes milk. You call one thing milk, you call the other thing that. What's the difference? This is, I don't know what to say. Then he said, I made a bigger mistake commenting on the tastiness of the eggs. And the waiter drew a crass analogy of what eggs were. Lewis says, the person of John, I was silent. I didn't know what to say. He said, but a few moments went by, and reason came riding on a horse and rescued me. And as reason rescued me, I looked back at the mountain with his Neronian stare of the spirit of the age, and I said to him, sir, you lie. You lie because you don't know the difference between what nature has meant for nourishment and what nature has meant for garbage. You lie. You don't know the difference between what nature's meant for nourishment and what nature's meant for garbage. And I want to tell you something in the academic world. We are redefining things, and we think by changing names, we reconstitute its essence. In 1981, was it? No, 1983, September 1, 1983. Korean Airlines 007 started off from New York on its journey to Seoul. And after making its stop, was on its final leg coming into Seoul and strayed off course. And two Russian fighter planes came in side by side and shot that plane down. And all 200 Korean Airlines passengers were sent into midair, blown to smithereens. And an investigation began. And a Western journalist by the name of William Sapphire was talking to the Russian prestigious journalist by the name of Vladimir Posner. And I watched the exchange. And Sapphire said to him, how could you justify this? And Posner said, you understand that there were no lights on in that Korean airliner. And Sapphire said, that is not true. The lights were on. He said, no, Mr. Sapphire, they were not on. I said, but the recording of the conversation says that the lights were on. He said, ah, you got it wrong. What it meant was these two Russian pilots talking to each other said their lights were on. Sapphire said, Mr. Posner, let me read for you the exact transcript from the exchange. One Russian pilot said to the other Russian pilot, target's lights are on. Was one of you referring to your comrade as a target? You know what? When 200 bodies can be sent floating from the air to an early death, and somebody can start playing word games with you, it's pretty tragic in life when people are sacrificed at the altar of deceit and language. It is incredibly important that you and I find our definitions and find that coherence and that cogency and a legitimate representation of what is essentially true. That is why two great philosophers from two completely different perspectives, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, and Anthony Flew, the sophisticated philosopher in the 90s, both of them, in the latter years of their life, said they were making their change in their own philosophy. Sartre, actually, I've documented it in one of my books, said his existential atheism was ultimately unlivable. Because when he saw what was happening in Vietnam and saw all that was going on, he could not avoid judging morally what he thought ought not to be done. And he found his own philosophy, he said, unlivable. And Anthony flew, struggling with his own struggle in moral thinking in his latter years before he passed away. I am a firm believer of the fact that poets and artists sometimes face reality with a greater degree of truthfulness than abstract answers can, or philosophers can. And here's what one rock group said: Cat's foot, iron claw, neurosurgeons scream for more from paranoia's poison door, 21st century schizoid man. Blood rack, barbed wire, politicians, funeral pyre, innocents raped with napalm fire, 21st century schizoid man. Death seed, blind man's greed, poets starving, children bleed, nothing he's got he really needs, 21st century schizoid man. Now here's the point. The walls on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. Will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time are sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh, but I'm afraid tomorrow I'll be crying. You see, when a woman or a man sits in front of the lens of a camera, disrobed, in order to titillate just the baser bent in a human being's mind, purely for erotic persuasion, nothing more than that, something within her ought to stop and say, no, I must have a sense of shame that guides me. I won't do this. But you see, when secularization has had its complete sway, what it will do is destroy a person's sense of shame. That's what happens. And if shame is gone, you actually are in the process of making a monster on a journey. I think the definitions are so critical and so important. I don't know anybody whom I have met whose marriage broke up because he went to see museums and art galleries quite often. But I do know a lot of people whose marriages have collapsed because of the erotic escapes into a mindset that no one human being can ultimately satisfy. My youngest daughter works in the rescue of women from the sex trafficking industry and children with AIDS. She's Yehi. And I don't know how many times she's said to me, Dad, would you please write a book on pornography with me? Because every one of these people that have exploited the women that I have seen and gone that route, a vast majority of them had their beginnings in pornography. Marriages have been shattered, and humanity has become debased to a point where no one human being can satisfy the imagination. And I've told her, I said, honey, I just don't want to even dabble in that stuff, to write on it. She says, no, no, you write on what it is meant to be. I'll write on what it is, because I've seen it eyeball to eyeball. What happens? So when we make a crass statement in a courtroom that there is really no difference, you can only say that if all definitions have been destroyed of human essence, purpose, meaning, and essential worth. Secularization, no shame. End result. We go to pluralization. It's a legitimate expression, pluralization, again in society. But what happens when pluralization has its sway? Pluralization is where there's a competing number of worldviews available to its members and no one worldview is dominant. Where there is a competing number of worldviews available to its members and no one worldview is dominant. In California, you can go on Los Angeles and see a guy pushing his wagon. He's a Korean selling kosher tacos. That's pluralization of food. Wonderful. When I moved to Canada, I was 20 years old. There was only one Indian restaurant, and it was horrible. I was not married at that time, and I used to sit there and say, why on earth am I coming here? It doesn't have a semblance of Indian food, but nobody knew any better. Today you go to Toronto, which is the most volitionally pluralistic society in the world, intentionally cross-cultural. You get the best Indian cuisine you'd ever want to see. London possibly accepted, and maybe India has a handful of them better, I don't know. But I just want you to know, pluralization has wonderful ideas. Our team, headquartered in Atlanta and gathered around the world, when we stand up and talk and listen to each other, it's wonderful to hear the different accents. It somehow doesn't sound the same. When I hear it in America, Michael Ramsden can read the grocery list and it sounds sophisticated. You know, accents are great things. Food is a great thing. Values, sometimes you see these things, how they're expressed. I love the way they greet you in India and Thailand, like this, you know. And then you go to some parts of the world and they slap you on the back, you know, say, how are you doing, bud? When I was at Texas A&M 10 days ago, you stand up and say, howdy. That's the way you greet them. You know, you feel like putting on a hat and boots and you feel you belong. Pluralization is a great thing. But if pluralization and pluralism is taken to absolutize relativism, then you've got a problem. What do I mean by that? You see, relativism simply can't be true. Now, I know I'm talking to most of you who are probably relativists. It simply can't be true. You'll have your chance in the Q&A time. Why not? If a person says all truth is relative, that either includes itself or excludes itself. If it includes itself, that means that statement is not also always true. That absolutes actually exist. One way or the other, the sword works. It either includes itself, which means it's not always true, or it excludes itself, which means it's giving you an absoluteness of testing while telling you there are no such things as absolutes. Let me illustrate this for you. Now, it's going to be a bit tough, but let me do this. If you've read my writings or heard this, I try to do this because I think this is very important. You follow this. You see, there are basically three laws of logic, and there are many that stand by them. One of the laws of logic is the law of non-contradiction, that a statement that is contradictory at the core, making two opposite claims, could not be true without qualifying one of the assertions in some way. We do that in a court of law. So I remember years ago in California, I was speaking on a series of talks, and a professor, an American professor, came up to the front and he said to me, I don't like the things you say. He said, I dare you to speak on the subject why I am not a Hindu, and I will bring my entire class in philosophy and they will tear you to shreds. I said, that's supposed to be a very exciting prospect for me, that I select your subject and your students are going to tear me to shreds. I said, why do you say that? This is an American gentleman, you know. And he said to me, well, I have become one. I have become a Hindu. And he said, and when I listen to you talk about the Christian faith and so on, I just think you ought to talk on why you are not in the religion of your land of your birth and so on. He didn't worry about the religion of the land of his birth, but he was worrying about the religion of the land of my birth. And he said to me, you talk about that and we will take care of you. I said, no, sir, I won't do that. I tried to humor him. I said, I've heard when you take mud and throw it at others, not only do you get your hands dirty, you also lose a lot of ground. He didn't think that was very funny. So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. I will speak to you on why I am a Christian and let your class come and tear me to shreds. I'll be ready for that. So the next day he came there. You should have seen them coming in. My goodness. The only thing they looked like, they weren't carrying any weapons, but the stares were enough in that one corner to make me just terrified. So I just looked on the other side and spoke the whole evening. At the end of it, he came forward with this whole entourage and he looked at me and he said, "You know what? You may have spoken on why you are a Christian, but you gave some logical reasoning and so on. I can see now why you are not a Bible, you don't belong to Hinduism, you're not a Hindu, because you obviously don't understand Eastern logic." I said, "All right, sir, let me tell you something. You got a whole entourage behind you, and you're trying to impress them, and I'm going to try and impress them. I don't want this game. Let's go out and have a meal. You pay, I'll pray, and we'll talk." So he agreed, and he said, "Can I bring the professor of psychology with me?" I don't know why, whether he was bringing somebody to study both of us. I said, "Yes, let's go." So we arrive in this Los Angeles restaurant, and he takes my placemat, the other professor's placemat, the third placemat, and his placemat paper, and he stacks it up because he's going to draw out his argument for me. He started off with this statement. He said, "Mrs. Zacharias, there are two kinds of logic. Actually, I should tell you, that's wrong. But you don't stop anybody that soon." So you allowed him to keep going. He said, "There is a Eastern logic and a Western logic." He said, "In the West, we think either this or that." It was the same idea of coherence. You see, we don't want to be. You think either this is right or that is right. And so we have this either or mentality in the West. And so we dismiss anything that doesn't agree with us. And he said, "That is a Western way of thinking." I said, "No, it's not." He said, "Yes, it is." I said, "No, it's not." He said, "Yes, it is." Finally, he said to me, "Who are you to tell me it is not?" I said, "All right, keep going." And then he talks to me about the both and logic. It is not either this or that. It is both this and that, a la Hegel. You know, first you take the thesis, which spawns its antithesis. You put it together and it forms a synthesis. That in turn becomes a thesis, spawns an antithesis, and you get a synthesis, and you keep going in this dialectical way. He said, "Like Marxism." I said, "Yeah, the classless society. Nobody ever shows you one. But here it is, both this and that." He said, "That's an Eastern way of thinking. They don't think non-contradictorily. They think dialectically, both this and that." And he said, "Ravi, your mistake was this. When you were studying that Eastern worldview, you studied it as a Westerner thinking either or. You should have studied it as an Easterner thinking both and you would have had no problem looking at all the contradictions in the Eastern worldview. They live with contradictions, not a problem," and so on. So he's waxing eloquent, you know, on all of this. Finally, I took one of his placemats on which he'd scribbled. I said, "I have just one question for you. When I am studying the Eastern worldview, you are telling me that I either use the both-hand system or nothing else. Is that right? That I either use the dialectical system or nothing else. Is that right?" He didn't even eat his lunch. The psychologist and I had finished ours. He put his knife and fork down, which he had just picked up. And I quote, here's exactly what he says to me. He says, "The either or does seem to emerge, doesn't it?" I said, "Yes, sir. Even in India, we look both ways before we cross the street. It is either the bus or me, not both of us." And I said, "And you know what you've got wrong, sir? I hate to correct you. Do you know what you've got wrong? You've got it dead wrong. Gautama Buddha used the law of non-contradiction. That's why he rejected Hinduism in his way of thinking. Shankara rejected personal deities because he rejected with the law of non-contradiction to his way of thinking. Anybody who tells you that Eastern philosophers live with the dialectical method have a half-truth. Existentially we do, but theoretically that is not true. Shankara believed rigorously in the law of non-contradiction. His way of dealing was with debates. He debated the opposition. I said, so sir, it's got nothing to do with East or West. It's got everything to do with what is true and rationally tenable. That's the way we look at it. When I was telling one of my former Hindu friends that, he started laughing. He said, that's why you're an apologist and I'm just an ordinary pastor. He said, even though he was a nuclear physicist by training, he said, Ravi, if he'd said that to me, I would have simply said to him, if both and is all you crack it out to be, why can't I use both the and, both this and that? Why do I have to use just one of them? He said, you just came for it with the jugular, either this or that. The attack point would have been the same. You live a life of contradiction, it'll break down. It'll break down. You can't have your own law of gravity and say, I'm going to jump, but I'm not going to fall. You can't have your own moral theory and say, I can do whatever I want, and there's no payday someday. The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, there are absolutes by which we must govern our lives. Let me read this for you. This comes from a skeptic. It is an absolutely amazing article. This professor, a man by the name of Loyal Rue, writes an article and says, philosopher says, the world desperately needs a noble lie. Religious philosopher Loyal Rue says, modern culture urgently needs a noble lie. Such a myth that links the moral teachings of religion with the scientific facts of life. He said, science has eroded the plausibility of Judeo-Christian myths. They are gone. It has got into our heads and consciousness in such a way that the traditional myths can no longer be swallowed. These myths, he said, include archaic views of the universe, a presumption that humans are at the center of existence, and the stories of Jesus' resurrection and Moses bringing the Ten Commandments down. Dispel these myths of religion, he said, and all that is now left for us is actually nihilism, which considers life and the universe meaningless. The myths serve as a framework for religious teachings that brought about man's betterment, Rue says. Without their integration of cosmology and morality, of cosmic facts with idealism, people will ultimately deny fixed standards and do whatever they choose, splintering our society. Or they might embrace the totalitarian option, which relies on government to force human beings to behave, he said. Professor Rue, 46 years old, a professor of religion and philosophy in Iowa, presented this thesis at a recent symposium of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. A church-going but skeptical man, Rue suggests that we start all over and we need to create a new myth, a noble lie that squares with what is known scientifically, something that is convincing even if it is not factual. What would that lie be? He doesn't specify. It remains for the artists, the poets, the novelists, and the musicians, the filmmakers, the tricksters and masters of illusion to winch us towards our salvation by seducing us into embracing a noble lie, he told the scientific meeting. Perhaps, he said in an interview, it is possible to rework plausible again. In any case, the illusion must be so imaginative, so compelling that it cannot be resisted, so beautiful and satisfying at the same time that all would feel they have to accept it and tear, he told the meeting. What I mean by a noble lie is one that deceives us, tricks us, compels us beyond all self-interest, beyond ego, beyond family, nation, and race, that will deceive us into the view that our moral discourse must serve the interests not only of ourselves and each other, but of the earth as well. Amazing. Come up with a noble lie that will deceive us. You know what he's saying? We're not going to make it. We're not going to make it with relativism. We have to have some absolutes. Secularization carried to its logical outworking, no shame. Pluralization ultimately kills reason. And finally, it comes to privatization. Privatization where we are forced to to keep our values and our spiritual beliefs in private and not bring it into the public square. The amputation of your greatest value from public proclamation. You know, I grew up in India, lived in Delhi till I was 20. India is my homeland. There's a beautiful Indian song. If any Indian is here, they'll know it. It goes like this. Mera juta hai Japani, patloon Inglistani, sar par lal topi Rusi, phir bhi dil hai Hindustani. My shoes may be Japanese, my trouser English, my hat may be Russian, but my heart is still Indian. It's in the blood. It's in your DNA. 80% Hindu, 10% Muslim, Sikhs, Zoroastrians, Christians, the rest. The Christian population growing quite significantly. I never, ever remember, even once, looking at my Hindu friends who had just come from the temple with the marks on their forehead or whatever and denying them that right. Never even felt it. All of my schooling, I had numerous Hindu philosophers and Muslim philosophers coming in lecture. Never had a Christian philosopher. I wasn't one myself. Did I sit there and resent the right of that man to tell me what he believed and why he believed it? No. It is part of academic growth to be able to listen to perspectives and counter-perspectives, even if you don't agree with it, and let the mind then come upon that which is true. Now you go to some American universities, as I went to one recently, for the first time in all of the years in one of the Ivy League schools, placards were being held up to stop you from speaking on the subject of tolerance. Quite amazing. Quite amazing. And I say, why? The motto at Oxford University is, "The Lord is my light." And Richard Dawkins is his own light. And it's okay. But he wants to block the light out for everybody else if they want to listen, discuss, and dialogue. That's not academic learning. That is demagogic imposition by castigating a worldview after making a caricature of it. Privatization. You see, what I believe about God has everything to do with what I believe about everything else. Something to the effect said by Chesterton, people debating whether he worded it in these ways or not, but the idea was this: God is like the sun, you cannot look at it, without it you can't look at anything else. In other words, your belief in God dictates everything you believe about all your other values. What happens with privatization when you break up your most treasured beliefs and don't bring it into public? You know what happens? You end up with a loss of meaning, the breakdown of meaning. Do you know in Belgium there's such a high rate of suicides now that they are changing the term? They are calling it opting out of life. Opting out of life. They don't want to call it suicide anymore. It is fascinating when you read the story of Oscar Wilde. And I will close with this in a quotation. I wrote a book on great conversations, imaginary conversation between Jesus and others. I did one with Jesus and Buddha, the lotus and the cross. One with Jesus and Krishna, new birth or rebirth. One with Jesus and Hitler, the Lamb and the Führer. One of them was called Jesus Talks to Oscar Wilde, Sense and Sensuality. Oscar Wilde lived a brilliant man, absolutely brilliant. When you read his book, The Picture of Dorian Gray, I think one of the greatest stories ever written. Brilliantly done. In his 40s, he's lying on his deathbed in Paris. The irony of Wilde's life, these two thoughts. If you go to his grave in Paris, it's a giant phoenix, a huge, huge stone of phoenix. He chose his own epitaph from the book of Job. My friends saw my suffering and were silent. A hedonist goes to a book on suffering to describe his life. And the irony was, lying in his deathbed, he looks at his lover, Robbie Ross, and he asks him an incredible question. He said, "Robbie, did you ever love any one of those young boys for their own sake?" Robbie Ross says, "No." He said, "Neither did I." The using of a person for self-fulfillment was haunting him even as he was dying. And he called for a priest. You see, pleasure is a greater problem than pain when pleasure has been unlimited and emptiness still comes in. G.K. Chesterton said, "Meaninglessness does not come from being weary of pain. Meaninglessness comes from being weary of pleasure." And so I say to you, secularization will lead to the loss of shame, pluralization to the loss of meaning, and privatization to the loss. Now, pluralization to the loss of reason, and privatization to the loss of meaning. No shame, no reason, no meaning. That's the control of secularism. I close with this. Daniel Yankelevich started defining culture as a search for a coherent set of answers to the existential questions that confront all of us in the passage of our lives. And then he says this, "The rules in America are changing. The rules in America are changing, and we are witnessing the death of values and the death of a culture." He wrote that 30 years ago. He ends his article after doing a survey with a large number of young men and women, asking them some questions, and he ends with these words. After talking to a couple by the name of Abby and Mark in an open and a free relationship, here's what he says. "If you feel it is imperative to fill all your needs, and if these needs are contradictory or in conflict with those of others or simply unfillable, then frustration will inevitably follow. To Abby and to Mark as well, self-fulfillment means," listen to this now, "to Abby and to Mark, self-fulfillment means having a career and marriage and children and sexual freedom and autonomy and being liberal and having money and choosing nonconformity and insisting on social justice and enjoying city life and country living and simplicity and graciousness and reading and good friends," and on and on. But the individual is not truly fulfilled by becoming even more autonomous. Indeed, to move far in this direction is to risk psychosis, the ultimate form of autonomy. The injunction that to find oneself, one must lose oneself, contains a truth any seeker of self-fulfillment needs to grasp. The injunction that to find oneself, one must lose oneself, contains a truth any seeker of self-fulfillment needs to grasp. Jesus Christ said, "If anyone will come unto me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." The Apostle Paul made the comment, "I die daily." There has to be a death to self that the purpose and the meaning that God has made you for can ultimately live and triumph in a secularized, pluralized, privatized existence where shame goes, reason goes, and meaning goes. It tells you just to indulge and indulge and indulge. And Abby and Mark found out they had it all, and yet inside had nothing. So I leave those for thoughts with you, and we have a time to interact with your questions. Thank you so much for patiently giving me a hearing.